So welcome, everybody. This is Mark Reynolds from Citizens Climate Lobby. You're on our December call. You know, I think usually this time of year, people would see things kind of winding down and that people's activity would be slowing down. But holy cow, what a month you just produced. We had a lobby day in Washington, D.C., where we saw over 110 congressional offices. We just finished our second ever Canadian conference, which was bigger, more visits on Parliament Hill, better speakers, amazing. A REMI briefing in both the House and Senate, a regional conference in Des Moines, and a regional conference also in Austin as we speak today. So what a remarkable month everybody on this call has produced. I also especially want to welcome the brand new chapters who started the group since last month's call. So that includes Rutledge, Missouri, San Antonio, Texas, Pueblo, Colorado, Seminole County, Florida, Annapolis, Maryland, Toledo, Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, Jonesboro, Tennessee, Rockford, Illinois, and then today, as we speak, the greater Miami area is starting the group, which is also fantastic given how important Florida is to climate change. Okay, so one of the areas that we need to get our head around is certainly the area of soil and agriculture, and today is one of many calls that we will use to address that issue. One thing that I think you can always count on Citizens Climate Lobby is its laser-like focus on what it's doing. I know a lot of you are aware that before I came to CCL, I spent a lot of time working to improve effectiveness inside of organizations. And the consultative part of that was really organized around one proposition, and that was you can never over-focus an organization, but you can certainly under-focus one. You can try and be too many things to too many people. And so one of the things that we have been very, very clear on is until we get one thing done, which is a steadily rising price on carbon-based fuels, we're not going to do anything else, and that is the case also. And it's why I think because of that clarity that we're able to have both our country's leading climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen, on our board, and also former Secretary of State Shultz. And when I started calling the carbon fee and dividend plan the Shultz plan, when I went to Secretary Shultz and said, you know, this is the plan you like, do you mind if we attach your name to it? Said, yeah, that was fine as long as we called it the Shultz-Becker plan, which is Gary Becker was a personal friend of his and a great economist, and so certainly anybody's welcome to use that name that they want to. So nevertheless, there's a whole bunch of issues that we've tried to get our head around on this call, ocean acidification, glaciers, and we need to do a lot of work on the area of soil and agricultural practices, and that's what our speaker is going to comment on today. I also want to say how grateful I am to the many people who are vegan and vegetarian who called me concerned about this call because they've made such a huge commitment in their life to reduce their own carbon footprint by eliminating meat as one of their sources of what they eat. And I have the greatest respect for that. And I also, given Mr. Savory's proposal has to do with increasing cattle, not decreasing it, which is what all of you have been working on, and I think you're going to be proven to be right. But nevertheless, I was very grateful, and that was one of the times where I was really proudest to be part of this organization because I had a lot of people raise serious objections but always do it in the most respectful, the most gracious way. Nobody was in any way ever small or petty, simply to say, here's the concerns I have and here's the personal stand I've taken, and I just want you to know I really, really appreciate your input, in particular the manner in which your input was brought. Nevertheless, let's get to Mr. Savory's comments. I believe that, I don't know how many of you have studied the concept of complex adaptive systems. We'll get a speaker who can speak to that issue at some point on the call, but essentially it's a notion that shows that certain systems left to do what they're supposed to do can do remarkable things. And I think soil will prove to be probably the ultimate complex adaptive system. So we're very, very interested in Mr. Savory's ideas about how we can restore the soil. You know, our first international conference, we had Lester Brown as our keynote speaker, and he said that the world faces four crucial problems: extreme poverty, climate change, population, and decertification of the earth. And certainly Mr. Savory's work addresses two of Mr. Brown's concerns. So Alan Savory, thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday. And after your opening comments, if there's time for questions, we will start with Liz Fisher in East Bay. Then there's a phone-in question from Oregon, and then we'll get to Boston if possible. So welcome to Citizens Climate Lobby, Mr. Savory.
Thank you very much, Mark. I'm honored to be involved in your discussion, and I love your comment about respectful discussion. I love that. Are you wanting me to just go off with some comments now?
Yes, yes, please go right ahead, sir.
Right. I understand from you that most people have looked at the TED talk on desertification, in which I said that only, I stressed only, livestock could now save the situation, really, of civilization as we know it. I'll return to that in question time if anybody doubts why, because some people took exception to any scientist using the word only, since which I've put it in bold in any of my talks, and there's a real reason for that. So we can return to that. Right now we have a world in which we're very compartmentalized, silo education, etc. And so if you look at the critical issues facing us, the most critical, I believe they are biodiversity loss, desertification, and climate change. And each of these is treated separately in academia and in conferences, organizations, etc., and in publications. But without biodiversity loss, desertification simply does not occur. Man-made desertification, I'm referring to. And it is only a symptom of biodiversity loss. And if we don't address desertification, we're not going to be able to seriously address climate change. So there really are one issue, but to hold a conference or a discussion discussing them as one issue today would be extremely difficult because of the way we're organized from academia on. So I'm going to go now right into the role of the importance of livestock in climate change. So I'll go straight into that and then get to discussion as quickly as we can. The main atmospheric pollutants we believe are causing climate change are coming from fossil fuels and agriculture, and then there's desertification contributing to climate change as well. So when we look at excess carbon in the atmosphere, nitrous oxide, methane, and black carbon, which is not a gas, and we look at desertification, I'll go through these quickly. We don't know the exact proportions of the gases carbon that are coming from fossil fuels versus agriculture. So for illustrative purposes only today, I'll just say let's assign them equal, as about equal, 50% from each. If we look at the fossil fuels contribution to atmospheric gases, so then we've got roughly 50% of the carbon, nitrous oxide, methane, and then 50% black carbon, all coming from agriculture, and 100% of desertification coming from agriculture. So let's assume now in a post-fossil fuel world where we've found a benign source of energy to replace fossil fuels and we have zero use of fossil fuels. If we look at that, from fossil fuels, we will stop adding to the atmospheric gases, 50% of the gases I mentioned and black carbon, but desertification would continue in a post-fossil fuel world. So in many ways, this makes agriculture our most dangerous issue because climate change is likely to continue even with 100% cessation of addition of gases from fossil fuels. Now, what will happen with agriculture's contribution if we only use the tools available to humans? We are a tool-using species, and we only really have technology in its many forms and fire with which to address global climate change, and we have the concept of resting the environment, land and oceans, to restore biodiversity. So let's call that a tool. We have three tools. If we try to address climate change using the three tools climatologists, scientists, ecologists, everybody in mainstream is using, we would then continue to add 50%, let's say, of all gases and black carbon, and 100% of the desertification would continue. So this is why I say we have no option but to consider the use of livestock properly managed. Now, we can discuss that in discussion time if need be. So take that as a given at the moment. What we can, if we now look at not simply adding the things that are contributing to the atmosphere, to climate change, if we look at safely removing the oceans are already apparently acidifying seriously, affecting many things, and it will continue. So we have mainly as a place to place excess gases, we have mainly the soil left to us. And if we want to do it safely, that is without unintended consequences through interfering in nature, if we can look at the removal, then we can safely remove the gases from the atmosphere. What can we do using only technology, fire, and resting land? And the answer is none of them. None can be withdrawn safely. If we look at stopping the contribution to climate change from agriculture, if we accept the use of livestock properly managed on the land, we can stop adding all of the gases, but we can also now deal with the contribution of desertification, and we can now begin to safely remove all of the gases, legacy load, from fossil fuels and from agriculture if we use livestock properly managed and add them to our toolbox. So it means that only by adding livestock to the technology we use and everything else can we, I believe, safely not only stop adding but also reduce. So if I had to summarize that, because I said a lot in a short time, if I had to summarize that, we'd be saying, in effect, that without livestock, in other words, continuing to use only the three tools humans have, we can only stop a proportion of the gases that are contributing to climate change. We can only stop a proportion of the black carbon, which is not a gas, and we can do nothing about desertification. If we add livestock properly managed to our toolbox, open our minds to that possibility, we now have the possibility of stopping the additional gases and black carbon from all sources, because we'd be using technology on the replacing fossil fuel side, and we have the possibility of reversing desertification. So I don't know how more simply to summarize a very complex situation. So I think having said that, I'd like to go to discussion and let everybody or anybody who wants to challenge any of the points, because I would love for somebody to tell me where that is wrong.
Well, let me start with the people who started to ask questions, Mr. Savory, and then we'll see how far we go from there, okay? So let's start with Liz Fisher in the East Bay. Liz would need to *6 your phone to unmute it. Let's see if we can get Liz first.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay. So I just want to say I love this win-win way of sequestering CO2, in that it's not any dangerous or unknown high-tech geoengineering that stokes the ego of engineers, even though I am an engineer. But my question is, it's about the original herd, and I'm assuming that part of it is that they're part of the reason that we have desertification, but can they be introduced back at some point in time?
Are you asking to introduce the original megafauna of the world?
You know, like the, I don't know, the rhinoceroses or the elephants or whatever actually roamed that territory before it became a desert.
Yes, the possibility of reintroducing them is obviously always there, as possibilities are, but from my perspective, it's totally impractical today because 80% of the genera, roughly, became extinct thousands of years ago. Even, you know, if you look at Lewis and Clark in America and the wonderful situation they described, I believe that was already a seriously desertifying situation. I mean, they talk about the massive numbers of bison, but there used to be three species of bison. These were just remnants already at that time. And so being practical about it, if you look at the most problematic region of the world, right across North Africa through to Pakistan and India, up through the former Soviet republics to China, we're looking at an enormous chunk of the world there, 5% of that land or less can actually produce crops. So the rest of it is under agriculture, not crop production. Agriculture is the production of food and fiber from the world's land and waters. And so only livestock now can do what is required on the scale, with the speed, and at almost no cost. It would actually earn more income, living and livelihoods for people, and feed people. So I'm just being practical today, although I'm primarily a wildlifer, and you know my passion is to save the big game that we're losing so fast still in Africa, but I'm just being practical.
Alan, a couple of groups are saying they're having a little bit of difficulty hearing you, and that if you could speak a little bit louder, it would help them. And Susan, could you increase the mic on Mr. Savory's mic also? Great. Okay, good. So let me switch over to a couple of questions that were submitted to me. The first one was from Eugene, Oregon. Our founder of the Eugene Group, Milton Takai, wanted to know specifically what governments could do. And I'm assuming, given that the majority of our groups are in the U.S. and Canada, that question would be targeted towards those two governments, first of all.
So his question is, what could governments do?
To help this process, yes.
I'm afraid at the moment there's nothing governments can do, although they are going to be critical to solving the problem. If we look at system science and wicked problems in soft systems, in other words, humans, organizations and institutions, they cannot adopt institutionally new scientific insights ahead of public opinion. I cannot find a single example where that has ever occurred from Galileo to today. And in fact, I often say to people, 20 minutes of my talk on TED going to now approaching 3 million people overcame 50 years of resistance. Nobody is to blame for it. This is just how complex organizations operate. They always resist new scientific insights until there is a sufficient level of public opinion change. So governments are going to be crucial to this through policy, and we can talk about that, which needs to be holistic and no longer reductionist. But I don't believe they can change until public opinion shifts significantly.
Okay, and that's a fair point from us, and that's certainly what we consider our job. We believe that our job is to create political will so the politics, in a certain sense, becomes an inevitability. There was a question that kind of relates to that from Encinitas, from Judy Burlfine, who was interested in how you would implement and actually, you know, make something like this happen. What would be the cornerstones of a plan to actually implement what you're suggesting?
Cornerstones, let's call them, of that, we've got to do it at two levels. We have to do it on the land where pastoralists, farmers, ranchers are managing agriculture. And that management needs to be holistic, bringing in the additional tool and addressing social, environmental, and economic complexity on the land. Now, fortunately, we have hundreds of people already doing this on six continents over. We've lost touch with how many acres, but probably over 50 million acres today. So universities, environmental organizations, etc., are beginning to collaborate with our institute and gather data from that, which will all help facilitate institutional change. So that's already happening on the land, and we are instituting a strategy of encouraging locally led, formed, and managed hubs where people can collaborate around managing holistically on the land. Now, we have to also get policies to change, because if you look at the United States, and we're not alone in this, I found this in Germany recently and other places. For example, I was with the IFOM people in Germany, gave a talk there. We went out on the land. I was in awe of how much knowledge was in the room, in the speakers, from universities, farms, etc. And when we were out on the land looking at practices that clearly are contributing to climate change and desertification and so on, and saying to them, why aren't you doing what you need to do when you know what to do? And I got the answer time and again, we cannot because of laws and regulations. Now, those are all coming from government policies. So if you look at the United States, you find the same thing. It is virtually impossible today for many ranchers and farmers to do what they need to do. In other words, apply science to management on the land because of laws and regulations prohibiting it. So we public policies as well, but that has to be preceded by a shift in public opinion.
Okay, good. Let's shift over to Boston. Gary, did somebody in Boston have a question for Mr. Savory today? May take a second to unmute them.
Hi, Mark.
Are you there, Boston? Yeah, go ahead, Gary. We can hear you now. Yep.
And this is Jack in Boston. What policies, acts specifically, are ranchers and livestock managers being prohibited from carrying out by the government that would help climate change?
If you look at for instance, the management of the public lands, which are enormous in the United States, they are constantly facing situations where they are forced to use technology to address things like noxious plant invasions. They're constantly forced to keep livestock numbers very low, and so on. So these are the sort of things that are enforced by regulation, government policy, etc. If you look at noxious plants, just one part of that, they cannot be dealt with technology. And yet, just in the years I've been in the United States, by my calculations, we've spent probably well over $15 billion trying to kill so-called noxious plants without success with a single plant in a single state, while polluting the environment, advancing desertification, droughts, floods, poverty, violence, cultural genocide of the Western ranching culture, all being fostered by our policies. If you look at keeping the livestock numbers low, as we do with continuous grazing or various grazing rotations, etc., that is why I showed in the TED Talk National Park and a national park in New Mexico and a research plot where all livestock had been removed. So we take it to the extreme, lowering numbers to try to bring them to a level that the land can sustain. We take them to zero level, and as you saw in those pictures, the desertification is as bad as anything in the biblical lands or anything in Africa. It just wasn't in our thinking that rest could be as destructive as it is. So when you look at the three tools we have, technology, fire, or resting the environment, resting the environment is the most powerful tool we have at our disposal to restore biodiversity where the environment is perennially humid or nearly so. So if you rest oceans, biodiversity restores, although in changed form if you've lost species. If you look at conservation and the environmental organizations practicing conservation in the tropical forests, etc., they're doing the right thing. It is the most powerful tool to restore biodiversity. If you come and visit where I live half the year in Africa, we take people, visitors, to the nearby national parks to show them the severe loss of biodiversity under exactly the same practices. Resting the environment is extremely destructive when we get to environments where there are periods of dryness during the year, whether the rainfall is high or low. And so because our prevailing paradigm is that resting is good, nobody ever opposes those policies or laws or regulations. And anything regulating the animal numbers to try to control overgrazing, desertification through stocking rate is doomed to failure. And that's why I used my own blunder in the TED Talk when I pointed out that in newly forming national parks 50, 60 years ago, I began to observe very severe loss of biodiversity. Because I was trained as a scientist, I believed this was due to too many animals, So did American Fulbrighters and Britain's top ecologist, Fraser Darling, who was working with me. We all believed the same. I was the guy on the ground that gathered the data, proved there were too many animals, and when my work had been inspected by a committee that was put together, they all agreed with me. Well, we were all wrong. As I mentioned in that talk, the government in subsequent years shot 40,000 elephants to try to bring the numbers down and stop the loss of biodiversity in national parks, but it's continuing as we talk now. We were all wrong.
Wow. Well, Mr. Savory, this time went way too quickly. You're welcome to stay on for the second half of the call when we go over some of the things that our volunteers have been doing, which I think you'll be excited to hear, but we'll certainly understand if your time is limited. But thank you so much for your work and for your time and for making yourself available today. We really appreciate it.
Mark, I deeply appreciate you involving me, and I'll hang on and listen. I'm so pleased to see what you're doing.
Great, fantastic. Okay, good. Well, what we're going to do is, just so for the people who have heads up about what we're going to hear from, is first we're going to hear about the Canadian conference from Kathy in just a second, and then Doug, heading up our efforts in Ohio, has decided that we should completely surround John Boehner, and did a really good job of that. So we're going to want to hear from that. We're certainly going to want to hear from that same kind of result, certainly about Kentucky regarding Mitch McConnell. And we are organizing there, but we need to be more organized. We're going to get a report on the Washington, D.C. Lobby Day, a new concept that we're trying out. We had two REMI briefings, one in the House and one in the Senate, that Danny will give us. And then I just have a few other things that I want to get to real quick, and then remind everybody that in January, the call is on the 10th, not on the 3rd. We want to give everybody plenty of time to get back from whatever you're doing. But let's start, first of all, with Kathy. Kathy, can you unmute your phone and let us know about the remarkable Canadian conference that I had the pleasure of being part of, just a little part of, but I didn't get to go on Parliament Hill. So can you, are you there, Kathy?
Yes, thanks for coming to Ottawa, Mark.
Yeah, what a pleasure.
Yes, okay, so I've got only 2 minutes to report, so here I go. So this is the fourth November in a row that Citizens Climate Lobby has been on Parliament Hill lobbying, and it's our second annual conference in lobbying days. In 2013, 36 climate advocates lobbied on Parliament Hill, and in 2014, there were 68 of us. In 2013, we lobbied 26 parliamentarians and two aides. In 2014, we brought our carbon fee and dividend solution to 41 parliamentarians, two aides, and the Office of Canada's Environment Commissioner. Some of the highlights from the conference include lunch with the all-party members of the All-Party Climate Caucus. In that lunch were MP John McKay, Kirsty Duncan, Elizabeth May, Bruce Heyer, and citizen climate lobbyist, and Frank Valliott, MP for Guelph, helped make that happen. We also had breakfast with some members of the NDP, and we co-hosted that with my member of Parliament, Glenn Thibault. And we also were given a gracious introduction to a Senate Liberal meeting about climate change. And this introduction was done by my Senator, Matt E.P., Charette Poulin. I have to say, at the end of our conference, I was a little scared because I don't know how we're going to make it better next year, Mark. Everyone brought their A game, and I dare not mention one person because then I have to mention everyone, and I only have 2 minutes. A good indication of how good our conference was is it has had over 1,600 views on YouTube. Unfortunately, the YouTube's currently down because of copyright issues.
Okay.
And that will be back up online. Finally, a comment from one of our volunteers, I think, really sums it up. Liz Armstrong in Erin said, "Heading into the Christmas season with more hope than I can ever than I had in a long time," and three politicians shared privately with me, and I'm going to try not to choke up what I say, but what we're doing is giving them hope. And finally, I want to thank everyone across the planet who is working on this issue and working with Citizens Climate Lobby. We are all making a difference. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, go Twin Cabs.
And Kathy, we will be able to get access to that, to the recording, because that economic panel was really, really impressive. So we will, that will come back up at some point, right?
Oh yeah, we're working on it. We have
okay.
That's a day's work for someone, and yeah, Nick
okay.
and Mississauga has graciously agreed to get that back up. Oh, definitely, it's a priority. It's just time is not on our side right now.
Okay, all right, great, Kathy. Thank you so much. It was such an honor to be part of that, and thank you for putting together such a remarkable event.
My pleasure. Bye.
All right, bye. Okay, good. So then let's go down just a little bit south of there, down to Doug in Ohio. Again, you know, Mr. Boehner's been a speaker for a while, and he's going to continue to be speaker, and so us providing a lot of love and a lot of support of Mr. Boehner is important. So, Doug, can you tell us a little bit about what we're doing or what we have done to get the state of Ohio organized?
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. This is the story of how Ohio added 5 groups in 1 year. In Springfield, they had already formed a small local club that wanted to address global warming. When a leader read about CCL in a New York Times blog post, he looked into us, spoke with Madeline Parra, and after some discussion, everyone agreed to convert their club to a CCL chapter. In Delaware, there was a speech at a local university about global warming. When asked what citizens could do, the speaker directed audience members specifically to CCL. Two of those in the audience then listened to the introductory call, rounded up some friends, and next thing they knew, Ellie Sparks was on her way from Virginia to facilitate their group start. In Cleveland, our first volunteer in that city read about CCL and volunteered to help start a group. He had already organized a local clearinghouse for several environmental organizations there, and so he had a good base of contacts from which to start. In addition, one of our members from Cincinnati drove to Cleveland and handed out flyers and talked to people at 2 environmental events, a Pachamama workshop at a UCC church and a presentation about global warming at a Unitarian church. In Columbus, a local volunteer read about CCL, spoke to Ellie, who then linked her up with our group in Delaware. Some of the Delaware members drove to Columbus and passed out flyers at a conference on global warming. The Columbus volunteer was already very active in the environmental movement and had a massive list of contacts. In Toledo, it was started by someone who attended the People's Climate March in New York City. At the march, they spoke to some of our recruiters and returned home fired up to make a difference. So in summary, here are some actions that we took. Once a target city was identified, the existing groups in Ohio combined contacts, email distribution lists, Facebook posts, etc., all looking for anyone in the target city who might be interested. We researched events and speakers in each target city and contacted the speakers beforehand to see if they would include us. We also researched organizations and churches that would be interested and sent them information about our group starts. In addition to our work, speakers at 3 different events specifically referred attendees to CCL. So what's the theme here? It was a total team effort involving so many people, paid staff, local volunteers, recruiters in New York City, and group leaders and members from other parts of the state, all working together to achieve this success. One of the benefits of this is that we've developed a map of Ohio with every community in which we now have a group highlighted with a big yellow star. We're going to send that map to our senators, representatives, and anyone else we can think of, and they're going to sit up and take notice.
Great job, great report. Doug, I think our plan for total world domination is rolling out rather nicely, and it's all starting in Ohio. Okay, good. Let's get Amy Bannon on for a minute. We tried something a couple weeks ago. You know, we have our annual conference in D.C., which I'll talk about in just a minute, and, you know, we saw over 500 members of Congress last June. We thought we should try a targeted activity where we were about as far away from an election as we could be to see if it's something we wanted to do on a regular basis. So, Amy, what ended up happening? First of all, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, Amy. Go ahead. Tell us about what happened at the lobby day.
Well, Mark, we decided to target the 4 congressional committees that are most relevant to citizens' climate lobby. In the House, we've got the Ways and Means Committee and the Energy and Commerce Committee, and in the Senate, the Finance Committee and the Environment and Public Works Committee. So those were our targeted offices that we wanted to meet. We had 62 volunteers participate, come to Washington, many from, of course, very close by Washington area, and we had 119 meetings that were actually set up and completed. That was 74 in the House and 45 in the Senate. So it was really incredible, and I'd love to give you more detailed information about every single meeting and all the wonderful things that happened and how well-received we were. But here's a little snapshot of what happened in a meeting that Jim Probst had, West Virginia Citizens Climate Lobby volunteer, when he went to Senator Manchin's office of West Virginia. So during the course of the meeting, the staffer came in three separate times to tell the senator that he had another meeting in the wings waiting, but the senator just kept saying, no, I want to keep talking to these people. So this was just, as I said, a snapshot of what happened, and just lots and lots of stories like that to tell. I wish I could tell them all.
Wow.
Now, what I'd like to do is add on to that. As you mentioned, Mark, it was like a completely amazing month for Citizens Climate Lobby. And to add to that, we also had, and this is a new world record, 219 letters to the editor published. And our this is year to date, that's for the month. Our total number of meetings so far year to date is 1,047 meetings with both Congress and members of Parliament offices. And that, again, is the second new world record.
All right, great, Amy. Thank you so much. And, hey, great job, West Virginia. Way to be developing that kind of relationship with your senators. West Virginia is definitely one of those ground zero states. Okay, then just to complete that week, so the 2 days after the lobby day, Danny, we had two REMI briefings, one in the House and one in the Senate. Can you tell us what happened there?
Absolutely, Mark. So first I'd like to give a little context. There's a group in D.C., EESI, and they're fantastic, and they will charge $10,000 to run a briefing. I chatted with their leader, and she gave me some advice, but with one conversation, we saved CCL some money, and we put on not one but two of these briefings. And the way I would describe this is that they exceeded any reasonable expectation. CCL had not done this kind of thing before, so this is totally new for us. But we managed to pack both of these briefings. In the Senate briefing, which happened first, we had over 70 staffers. A quarter of those staffers were from Republican offices, and the first person left 53 minutes in, which I think is remarkable because these are really, really busy people, and they were staying, they were asking questions, they stayed until the end. In the House, which was the next day, we again had over 70 staffers, and both these rooms did not hold 70 people, which meant that there was quite literally standing room only for both of these briefings. On the House side, we actually had to turn a few people away, including two members of Congress who wanted to come in and speak, but the room was full, so they had to be turned away. And in the House case, it was about a third of the staffers who were from Republican offices, and questions went 15 minutes after everybody could have left, which again I think is remarkable for people who are this busy. As you might guess, Scott Nystrom, who wrote the REMI study, did a phenomenal job. He knocked it out of the park. And one of the things that I think was really important about this is folks who have been meeting with us and sympathetic to us were incredibly impressed. They did not realize just how good you all are at communicating with your members of Congress, and their eyes were popping to see both of those briefings packed to the gills. So we definitely leveled up how people see CCL through Scott's presentation and through all the work you did to turn out your member of Congress's offices.
Yeah, Danny, I'll just echo on that because I had several groups contact me and ask how we could possibly pack those rooms. And all I said is that our volunteers have been committed to developing a relationship with people. They've been doing it for years, and when you make that kind of investment, it pays off. So congratulations on that to everybody who worked on that. That was a major step forward in us getting something done because of the number of people and the kinds of offices represented in those meetings. Okay, good. Lene, I want you to come on in just a second and talk about how we're doing with the fall appeal. Let me just throw one little shout out to our San Jose group, to Suds and John and everybody who's been on that group. They have been working on the San Jose Mercury News for 3.5 years and finally got an op-ed. That was 3.5 years of contacting them, sending them editorial pack is just never throwing in the towel. And 3.5 years later, it paid off. So for those of you in the San Jose chapter, special congratulations to you. I know there's a bunch of other people I should be mentioning because of all the letters and op-eds, but 3.5 years of nothing, finally something that was large. Lene, can you give us a quick update on how the fall appeal is going?
Hola, Senor Reynolds. I'm happy to report that our Too Too Much CO2 fundraising appeal is doing really well. We've raised over $100,000 already, and compared to last year's appeal, which also did really well, in the same time period, we've raised 30% more money, and we've brought in twice the number of donations. However, I'm not sure you're going to have to wear a tutu. It doesn't look like we're going to hit $500,000 before year end, which is understandable given it was such an ambitious goal. But the bottom line is our appeal is doing fantastic, and we've now brought in over $1.2 million from all of our collective fundraising efforts for the fiscal year towards our $1.5 million budget. So thank you, everyone, for your generous donations and your help fundraising, and we still have a few weeks left, so we might hit $500,000. With CCLers, you never know what's possible. You still might be wearing a tutu, Mark Reynolds.
Yeah, I doubt it, but thank you, everybody. Okay, good. All right. Steve Ball, can you give us the what we're doing in the U.S. and Canada? And then I have a couple things to wrap the call up today, everybody.
Sure, Mark, can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. Okay. So let's start with the Canadian actions. The first action is we're posing the question, what do you really want for Holiday Gift Canada? And the answer is political will for a sustainable world. And so please consider asking people you know to make a financial contribution to Citizens Climate Lobby and help us lay down the tracks for a low-carbon future. And then the second action, again, is Hey Canada. All we want for Christmas is our 17%, so send your Member of Parliament a holiday card asking for the 17% we committed to in the Copenhagen Accord. That would be the 17% reduction in greenhouse gases, and then extol the virtues of carbon fee and dividend. So that's what we're doing up in Canada, and down here in the U.S., our first action is to generate letters to the editor and op-eds to provide support for carbon fee and dividend as we head into the new Congress. And then the second action is to write letters to members of Congress, recently elected or reelected, congratulating them and asking them to support carbon fee and dividend. Now, going back to the first action of generating the letters to the editor and the op-eds, let's make sure that when we do get letters to the editor published, that we get copies of those letters to our members of Congress. So the best way to do that, of course, would be for the liaison to send that. But also, if you're a member in the group, even if you haven't gotten a letter to the editor published, you can print out or copy a letter that was published in your local paper, even if it wasn't yours, and send it to your member of Congress along with a note saying, hey, this is something that was printed in my paper, and it expresses my views about climate change and the solution to it. So there are many ways that we can put these in front of our members of Congress to get more out of it. And then, of course, with the op-eds at your meetings today, have someone assigned to write and submit an op-ed. We have several suggestions in the action sheet about different themes that you can be using during this month going into the holidays and so forth. So those are the two actions for us in the U.S.
Great, Steve. Thanks a lot. Okay, everybody, just a heads up again, the January call is going to be on the 10th, not the 3rd, so make sure you're marking your calendars for that. And for those of you who are making your plans for next year over the holidays, the June conference next year in Washington, D.C. is going to be June 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. Catherine Hayhoe is going to be there, so that's really, really great. And we're at the same facilities last year, but again, June 21st, 22nd, 23rd. We know Catherine Hayhoe and a bunch of other people will be there, so we're very, very excited about that. If you look at this month's Laser Talk, it refers to the conversation that I had with Secretary Schultz when I sent him a note and said, hey, I've been referring to fee and dividend, given how much you endorse it and support it and talk about it, it's the most transparent way to go is the Schultz plan.
And since I've been doing it, hey, is it okay with you? So the secretary is always great. And he said, yes, that's fine with him as long as we call it the Schultz-Becker plan. Now, Gary Becker was a friend, an economist of his friend who died last year, who wrote op-eds with him on this subject. And so we're not saying you have to go call this the Schultz-Becker plan. You do not have to do this. This is not a new rule. This is just something in your arsenal, so that if you want to refer to this as the Schultz-Becker plan, you are certainly welcome to do so. But you should also feel completely comfortable just calling it carbon fee and dividend. All right, everybody. Well, listen, thank you. What an incredible month. 219 letters to the editor, over 1,000 meetings with members of Congress now during this year. Double RIMI briefings in the House and the Senate. We had another one in Chicago last week with a major foundation that really helped a lot of places. So thank you, everything, for all you're doing. Let's keep the push up till the end of the year, and we'll talk to you again on January 10th for the call. Thank you all so much, everybody. Bye now. Danny, you can unmute people so you can hear people sign off. It's great.
Bye, Mark.
Bye.
It's the same thing.
Pardon on you.
Hi, everybody.
Everybody.
This crowd of voices. Yeah. All right. Anyway.
Hi, Mark. Thanks. Bye. Thank you, everybody.
All guests have been unmuted.
I thought I got out. Great work, everyone.